Vamos.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Flomenhoff, and I represent plaintiff appellant Timothy Euland. As this court is aware, this is a Federal Tort Claims Act case in which Mr. Euland claims that he was injured in a May 29, 1996 rear-end collision involving two Bureau of Prisons vehicles while he was being transported between prisons. At trial, Mr. Euland presented substantial evidence that he was injured and that any pre-existing injury he had was aggravated by this rear-end collision. This testimony included both expert testimony and objective medical evidence, including an MRI report.
Mr. Flomenhoff, did you raise on direct examination of Dr. Wilson the possibility that the accident aggravated Mr. Euland's pre-existing condition?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. On appeal, Mr. Euland has raised four. The district court below ruled that Mr. Euland had not established proximate cause, even though the government had breached its duty of care to him, and therefore awarded him no damages.
But let me go back to my original question. If you did so, wasn't the government then entitled to inquire into the validity of that statement?
Under normal circumstances, the government would be entitled to inquire about a subject that's raised on direct examination during its cross-examination. However, in this case, the issue that was raised was a separate claim under Illinois law, which is for aggravation of a pre-existing injury. And that is completely admissible evidence. However, the federal rules of evidence apply equally on cross-examination, and the government may not cross-examine with inadmissible evidence. In this case, the prior injury evidence was inadmissible under the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in Voykin versus the State of DeBera, where the court held that prior injury evidence is not relevant unless there is expert testimony propounded by the defendant to establish the relevance of the prior injury and the connection between the prior injury and the current injuries.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Flomenhoff. The district court, while certainly brief in its concluding remarks, is it not possible the district court could have been saying that he really just didn't think, as the government has now argued on appeal, that the accident was even noticeable to the people in the van, and thus individuals such as Mr. Euland in the van couldn't have been thrown against the wire cage and so on. In other words, sort of none of this ever really happened. There was a little tap, you know, it was in slow traffic, and really it was for that reason, as opposed to any of these fancy things about how bad was his back before the accident, how bad did it become after the accident, and so on.
It is, of course, possible that the district court may have come to that conclusion, but what the district court told us expressly in its limited comments was that it placed particular consideration on the prior injury evidence. It made no mention whatsoever about anything related to the actual accident. Plus, there was plenty of evidence in the record that controverted any claims that this was somehow a minor fender bender. There is a picture of the chase car, which was pretty smashed up. It was so smashed up that it was not even drivable, and it had to be towed. And in addition, the force of the impact was so hard that the chase car was wedged underneath the van and had to be pried out before they could even tow it away. So there is substantial testimony also from the witnesses, Mr. Tai, whose deposition was excluded, and Mr. Euland, both prisoners in the van, testified that they were not seatbelted, that the force of the impact was great, they were thrown forward. So there was a lot of controverted evidence and a lot of disputed evidence on that point, and the district court made no mention. But what it did mention was this prior injury evidence.
So your position would simply be that we have to rely on that. If the district court had made a finding that he didn't think it was a very serious accident, then you'd be dealing with clearly erroneous review on such a finding, but you're saying there just isn't one.
Yes, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record to indicate. Regarding the on this proximate cause issue, the district court had to make both factual and legal determinations, and as such, because this was a bench trial, and as such, is not accorded the same deference as a purely factual finding. It's a mixed question of fact and law, and is reviewed for clear error. And it's clear, as I just noted, that the district court did rely on this prior injury evidence, and that this prior injury evidence is inadmissible under the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in Boykin.
Well, of course, I mean, the district court also relied on the testimony of the officers concerning what they viewed as the mild nature of the accident, and I think he probably, you know, what he viewed as the somewhat unimpressive credentials of Dr. Wolfman.
Well, Your Honor, that's an interesting point, because the district court told us in its conclusion that it considered the credibility of the witnesses, but it doesn't say anything about what it thought of that credibility. It doesn't say that the witnesses were not credible or that they were credible. It just simply says that it considered it. So it's sort of speculative to try and read the tea leaves as to where the district court came out on this credibility determination.
He didn't say which witnesses he was finding credible and which not credible, did he?
No, he did not. He simply said that he relied on the credibility, and he didn't make any statement one way or the other about any particular witness.
Mm-hmm. But what about, I mean, the government has said, look, you know, this is a federal trial, the federal rules of evidence apply. Illinois may have its own rules about whether it wants independent expert evidence before this kind of thing can come in, but we're not an Illinois court. Why should we care about what Illinois says on the subject?
Well, number one, as this is a Federal Tort Claims Act, substantive law, state, or the place of injury is applicable. In this case, that would be Illinois, as the injury occurred in Illinois. And this court has held that the determination This court has held that when state substantive law supplies the rule of decision, as it does in this case, that the determination whether evidence is relevant must be made with reference to state law, and that the determination whether evidence is admissible is determined by the federal rules of evidence. So state law...
This looks very much like an admissibility decision rather than a relevance decision. You're not arguing that it's not relevant whether this man was previously injured or whether this accident contributed to that injury. The dispute here is how that underlying factual proposition is to be established.
Your Honor, we're actually arguing both points. The first point is under the Boykin decision, because there was no expert testimony to establish the relevance of the prior injury.
The relevance of the prior injury is clear. The question is, how is that relevant proposition to be established? The testimony is plainly relevant, as anybody would use that language. It's just a question of whether it's sufficiently reliable. And reliability decisions are made normally under the rules of the court. They're just local rules questions.
Yes, the federal rules of evidence would govern the admissibility, but the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in Boykin is completely based on a relevance determination. The court in Boykin indicated...
I don't see how. In what way did it say that this is not evidence that would make more likely some fact important to the outcome of the case? That's what relevance is.
Well, interestingly, the Illinois Supreme Court has adopted the federal rules of evidence on relevance. So they're applying the same standard. And what the court looked at was, as Your Honor pointed out, the reliability of this evidence. And the court was focused on whether or not the average layperson would be able to understand the complex nature of the connection between a prior injury and a current injury. whether or not to the same part of the body or not. And the court looked to its medical malpractice cases where it had said that expert testimony is required because this evidence is so complex and so difficult that the average layperson cannot readily appraise it. So they took that from their medical malpractice cases and they brought it into this context, which is basically a negligence context, and said that you need...
As you've just described it, it has nothing whatsoever to do with relevance.
Does it make any difference to us whether the Illinois Supreme Court called it a relevant standard, or do we need to look behind the language used in the Illinois Supreme Court's decision? Because I'll agree with you that Boykin says they're establishing a bright-line relevancy standard. So they use the word relevancy, but is that the end of the discussion?
Well, I think it's definitely the beginning of the discussion. That's the starting off point.
Okay.
And then there's an admissibility question that the district court can pass on applying the federal rules of evidence. For example, whether or not the prejudicial value outweighs the probative value under Rule 403. The district court certainly can apply that. But I think because the Illinois Supreme Court, the decision in Boykin was pretty clearly worded, and as you pointed out, it does say it's a relevant standard, and I do think not only is that the starting point, but that for the purpose of that limited analysis, that's the ending point, and then the federal rules of evidence take over from there.
Okay.
In addition, in this case, the trial court failed to bar the expert testimony, bar defense counsel's cross-examination of plaintiff's treating physician, Dr. Reed. This was following two separate and independent improper ex parte contacts on the part of defense counsel with Dr. Reed. The first one occurred when Dr.
Here your problem is even more serious. Is there any contention that this Illinois rule that you're relying on has anything to do with relevance?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your question, Your Honor.
Is there any contention that the Illinois rule that you're now relying on for this proposition has anything to do with relevance, that is, with the substantive definition? This looks entirely procedural.
There's no contention that this has anything to do with relevance, Your Honor. However...
And so, therefore, how would a state law rule be applicable in this federal litigation?
This court has held that a state rule, even if denominated a rule of evidence or cast in evidentiary terms, will be given effect in a federal case applying state substantive law if the state rule is an expression of and in furtherance of a state substantive policy that seeks to regulate behavior outside the courtroom. The Petrillo Doctrine is just such a policy.
I don't understand how that could conceivably apply in a case under the Federal Tort Claims Act. The case under federal law, state law is being applied as a rule of substantive decision. There's no other respect in which state law is applied. The whole claim is federal. It's a claim against the federal treasury. And this is as federal a lawsuit as one gets. This is not diversity litigation.
With all due respect, Your Honor, state law does play a prominent role in Federal Tort Claims Act cases because it applies a substantive rule of decision.
It supplies a substantive rule of decision. There are actually lots of overrides in the Tort Claims Act.
Are there overrides for the law of privilege? Or is this one of those things under the federal rules of evidence to which one refers to state rules of privilege?
I believe Your Honor is referring to Rule 501.
Yes.
And I would submit that Rule 501, although supplying a potential basis for getting at this issue, is probably not applicable because, in this case, the physician-patient relationship in the Petrillo Doctrine does not implicate an element of a claim or defense to which state law supplies the rule of decision.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Fallenhaus. Ms. Wallace. Oh,
good morning, Your Honors. May I please report? As you know, this is a case about a very minor traffic accident, and the parties...
Well, that's disputed, yes. Of course. It was a picture in the record of the car, which didn't look, if it had been my car, I would have been unhappy.
The parties tried two very different cases, and as you can see, we submitted two very different briefs. And the defendant's clear theory of the case, based on direct eyewitness testimony of three occurrence witnesses who testified that although the vehicles made contact and produced a bang, the reinforced prisoner van in which the plaintiff was riding did not move, jolt, and no one inside.
We understand that that's your position. What would you suggest that the district court make some findings on that question?
I suggest that they did when they said that when the district court said that
no,
it accepted.
No. Did you ask the district court to make some findings on this question? At the end of this case, the district court said things that can generously be described as sketchy. It might be helpful to resolve some of these issues, as questions previously asked. Yes, did you ask the district court to do that?
I did not, Your Honor. However, that was not raised on appeal, that the district court's decision was sketchy on anything. We have three legal questions that were raised by the plaintiff, and
the outcome of some of which appears to depend on what is true about some subsidiary findings. Take the hearsay question. Whether the hearsay error, and I view it as one of the plainest errors I've ever seen, is harmless or not, it depends on some of these subsidiary issues on which there are no findings.
I would say generally, when the court said that it was basing its decision that there was no proximate cause proven by the plaintiff, and it was relying on the credibility of the witnesses, that the court was relying on the credibility of the eyewitness witnesses who testified in court.
But there are two possible things the court might have been saying. It might have been saying that there was, you know, nothing but a little bump and it wasn't much of an accident and therefore nothing happened. Or it could be saying that, well, yes, he was thrown against the grate, but not every accident causes a new set of injuries, and could have said that this particular way that he got thrown in, looking at these medical records, we have no idea what this district court meant. And I don't know what fact-finding there is we're supposed to apply the clearly erroneous standard to.
For instance, wouldn't the deposition testimony have provided the only corroboration of Mr. Euland's claim that the collision was forceful, and wasn't that a central issue of the case? In other words, how can we be sure that it was harmless to exclude it unless we say that Mr. Chong Wan Tai was incredible as a matter of law? And I don't know how we can.
Which, of course, the district judge in his case didn't believe, since he won his case.
And the district judge in his case thought the officer's testimony was not credible
and awarded Mr. Tai $900.
Fine, but that means he won.
He won.
And that means the judge believed him. One would think, therefore, that would matter in this case. Now, I could imagine findings by the district court that would make it not really matter in this case, but the district judge never made them.
Your Honor, when he excluded the Tai deposition, I think he did so because it was classic hearsay. The plaintiff had...
No, it's not classic hearsay. The Rule 32 could not possibly be clearer. It says you're supposed to admit it if it would be admissible if the witness were testifying live in court. If Chong Wan Tai were testifying live in court, his statements would not be hearsay. So this is not hearsay.
I think before Rule 32 can be applied, there is some obligation on the part of the plaintiff to attempt to get Mr. Tai in. I think all of the federal
rules... There's absolutely nothing in Rule 32 that says that. I view your brief as... It is not an intellectually honest attempt to apply Rule 32. Rule 32 says the evidence can come in if one of four things holds. Unavailability is one of those four. Being more than 100 miles from the court is another. The rule says it comes in if A, or B, or C, or D. Your argument seems to be, notwithstanding A, B, and D, it doesn't come in unless C. And there's no support whatever for that in the rule.
Well, I think the case law has developed that there has to be some establishment by the plaintiff to attempt to get the witness in.
And what is the basis of that in Rule 32? What language in Rule 32 do you rely on for that proposition?
That he is unavailable. They must show that he's unavailable. They must show that he's
What language in Rule 32 do you rely on for that proposition?
I think I've stated it, Your Honor. I
you have not given me any language in Rule 32 yet.
She doesn't have the rules in front of her.
Yeah.
We'd be glad to give it to you. But the fact is, in the 100-mile section of the rule, most courts of appeals read it exactly the way the rule is written, and it all it says is the witness is more than 100 miles away. One court of appeals has fudged on that, but given the fact that we are also a court of appeals, we're entitled to look at the language of the rule, and I'll read it to you. The deposition of a witness, whether or not a party, may be used by any party for any purpose if the court finds, colon, B, that the witness is at a greater distance than 100 miles from the place of trial or hearing, or is out of the United States unless it appears that the absence of the witness was procured by the party offering the deposition. Now, nobody says that Mr. Euland procured Mr. Tai's residence in the Minnesota penitentiary, wherever he was. That was done all by other people. So, but that's the only qualification in that part of the rule is that you can't procure somebody's absence and then say, oh, he's 100 miles away from the courthouse, because plainly that would be abusive. But that's it. I read you the whole thing.
But I think by failing to file, to at least request a writ to have him come in for live testimony.
That's a different section of the rule.
It's a different section of the rule. There are five things, and they're separated by the word or. Now, if you had some textual basis in the rule, we would be happy to consider it. But just making up something that's not the rule and wishing we would do that instead is really hard.
You know, in retrospect, maybe I shouldn't have argued as strongly that the Thai deposition shouldn't have been admitted, but that wasn't part of plaintiff's case. Plaintiff listed Mr. Thai as a witness. He did not list the deposition as something that he was going to utilize as evidence in the case. And I think that even with the deposition, now we have three versions of the accident. We don't have the versions that the guards testified to and the version that Mr. Euland testified to. We actually now have a third version of the accident, that there had to have been two jolts and the car sort of spinning around because we have Mr. Tai hitting both sides of his head against the grate forcefully on two occasions. In retrospect, I could have handled that had I been notified that they were going to try to present Mr. Tai's deposition. But when they proceeded to cross-examine one of my witnesses reading from the deposition, and I objected as an out-of-court statement presented for the proof of the matter asserted, they backed off that strategy and said, well, then we will present a motion to have the entire brief admitted under Rule 32. And I feel that I had good grounds to argue that it should not be for all the reasons I just stated and those in my brief. I believe in looking at the judge's decision when he was talking about the credibility of the witnesses, the causal connection is broken if you believe the guard's testimony that there was no injury in fact to anyone. Nothing in the appeal, I believe, attacks the credibility findings of the district court or of the three occurrence witnesses that form the basis of defendant's theory that the plaintiff could not possibly have been injured. The three issues that Euland raises, I believe, are merely a smokescreen. I believe I should have been able to use the medical records to cross-examine their witnesses. I believe that they submitted Dr. Reed's entire deposition at trial for admission into evidence without raising the objection. Plaintiff didn't request that only those pages of the direct testimony be admitted. They raise a Petrillo objection that I believe is a smokescreen here, and so too the Thai deposition.
Mr. Post, I have to say, this isn't your doing, I'm sure, but I found incredibly ironic the government's position on the represented party point in this case, knowing how the Department of Justice went to the mat for years and years and years until Congress finally passed legislation trying to say that we're the only ones who get to contact employees of represented parties whenever we feel like it, and now finally, thanks to Congress, that rule of ethics applies to you. and when the shoe's on the other foot, it apparently feels different, I guess. As you were trying to say, Dr. Reed is a represented party, and you didn't want the other side, but that was not a proposition that you were willing to, you, the Department of Justice, were willing to grant others.
Your Honor, I can
I don't know if you're familiar with that today, but it went on for quite
a while.
I can
only address this particular case, and clearly he was a represented party with facts.
Your client hasn't given up on that even now.
True.
I believe that plaintiffs should not be rewarded for a tactical decision not to bring Mr. Thai in to testify live and give me the opportunity to cross-examine him. And when that tactical decision failed, change his strategy and tactics midstream without warning to the defendant after a final pretrial order was issued in the case, and give plaintiff another bite at the apple when Mr. Tai's deposition really just shows we have now a third version of the accident, one that's very different from Mr. Euland, and has Mr. Euland and Mr. Thai seated differently in the vehicles and crashing in a different way. And although the court made some comments about it being more than a fender bender, I think the testimony was that the van was riding much higher than the chase vehicle. They both came to a stop at approximately the same time, meaning that both of them were leaning in this direction, and the hood of the vehicle, the chase vehicle, hit the van, and causing the hood that damage, and then the bumpers locked when they came to a halt, causing that bang. But that the chase, no one in the chase vehicle was injured, and certainly no one in the van was injured.
That's the question, isn't it?
It was a question determined by Judge Vera, and he found in favor of the government. So I would ask unless the court has any other questions, that you affirm the district court's decision on this matter.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wallace. Anything further, Mr. Flamenhoff?
I'd like to point out that the government has been relying on the testimony of three Bureau of Prisons guards, none of whom is a medical expert, they're not a doctor, and more importantly, they never even asked the prisoners whether they were injured. All three of them testified, we didn't ask them, and they didn't ask. We asked, well, why didn't you ask? And they said, well, there were no cuts, scrapes, or bruises, so we didn't see anything wrong with them. However, each of them also admitted that soft tissue injuries, such as back and neck injuries, are not visible to the naked eye. So to say that the Bureau of Prisons guards are qualified to tell us whether Mr. Euland was injured or not doesn't make any sense. I see my time is up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.